Supercritical salutations from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're listening to The Critical Point on Aerogel.org. I'm your host and Aerogel.org co-founder, Steven Steiner, along with...
I'm Will Walker, and I'm also a co-founder of Aerogel.org.
So we would like to welcome you to Aerogel.org. Obviously, since you found this podcast, you're either interested in aerogels or interested in learning about aerogels. Yeah. So today we're going to give you a little bit of an overview about aerogel.org and our concept of open source nanotech.
Okay, so Stevie, let's get right to the point. Why don't you tell us what aerogel is?
Okay, so that's a great question, Will. So aerogel is not a... To start off, aerogel is not a substance. Actually, aerogel refers to a class of diverse materials. So aerogels are the lowest density, the lightest solid materials that have ever been produced. So they're a class of nanoporous, nanostructured solid foams. So they're dry, generally rigid materials with... that can possess an array of uncanny and extreme materials properties.
Wow. So what are those? Some of those properties that we're talking about here?
So most notably, aerogels are very low in density, as I mentioned. So the lowest density aerogels that have ever been produced happen to be the lowest density solids ever produced, and they're about three times heavier, only about three times heavier than air itself.
Does that mean they just blow away?
They tend to be very, they tend to get caught up in air currents pretty easily. And in fact, if you suck the air out of these extremely low-density aerogels with something like a vacuum pump, or alternatively fill it with helium, or take it and put it into a heavier gas, that like xenon, for example, you can actually make really low-density aerogels float, but only for a limited period of time. And that's because aerogels have an open cell structure. That is, the gas in the aerogel isn't trapped inside of closed spherical pockets. It's just sort of a diffuse sponge-like framework that makes up the aerogel's structure.
And like the way that a sponge can, water can go in and out of a sponge.
Exactly.
You can get air and other gases in and out of aerogel.
That's right. It can diffuse freely. That's right. So, in fact, aerogels can be made of a bunch of different things. So the prototypical aerogel, the aerogel that most people think of when they hear the word aerogel, is silica aerogel, which is is generally transparent with a sort of ghostly blue cast to it.
So if you've used Google image search, is that what...
Yeah,
I'm
most if
at?
You've seen a picture of an aerogel, you've most likely seen a picture of a silica aerogel. But that's only silica aerogels are really important, and there's been a lot of work done on silica aerogels, but there are many other kinds of aerogels. For example, carbon aerogels, which are totally opaque and totally black, and in fact electrically conductive, which silica aerogels are not. There's also other metal oxide aerogels, for example, iron oxide aerogels, which is basically a glorified version of rust, that are sort of a red-brown. The lanthanide metal oxides are all sorts of pastel rainbow colors. And there's even glow-in-the-dark aerogels, like the metal chalcogenide aerogels that Stephanie Brock at Wayne State University has made. So there are lots of cool different types of aerogels out there.
So, Stephen, why is it when I look at aerogels, if they have all these little pockets inside them, why can't I see any little holes in them?
Well, that's because the features of an aerogel are nanoscopic. So Deborah Rawlson... That's really small, that's right. So Deborah Rawlson at the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C. refers to aerogels as being the original nanotechnology, or sometimes a nanotechnology you can hold in your hand. So to give you some perspective, the pores in an aerogel typically range from between 2 to 50 nanometers in diameter. So a human hair might be 100 micrometers in diameter. So a pore of an aerogel is already over 1,000 times smaller, about 2,000 to 4,000 times smaller than the diameter of human hair. So it's really small.
Yeah, it's pretty small.
It's pretty small.
As an aside, I think it's interesting that whenever scientists talk about small things, they always compare it to a human hair.
It's because most people have hair.
That's true. I guess that's a good point. It's a common, you know... We all have. We can relate.
structure we can relate to, yeah.
All right, so that tells that gives us some of the exciting ideas about what's unique about aerogels. Maybe we should just talk about us for a little bit.
Don't you want to know how they're made, Will?
Oh, I'm sorry. hey, Stevie, how do you make an aerogel?
So, let's see. How is aerogel made? Well, aerogels start their life out as a gel. So this is where the word aerogel comes from. So people oftentimes think that aerogels are wet, kind of like wobbly, like gelatin dessert, and that's not true, actually. Aerogels are dry, generally rigid materials, although many aerogels today are now flexible, in fact, extremely mechanically robust in some cases. Aerogels start their life out as a wet gel, kind of like gelatin. So what is a gel? A gel is a colloid in which a network of nanostructured particles spans the volume of a liquid medium. So gels have the density of a liquid because they're about 95% liquid, 99% liquid in some cases generally, with the remaining part being the sort of delicate framework, solid framework that holds the liquid together into a solid form. And so what an aerogel is, so kind of like how Michelangelo's David was already in the marble and Michelangelo just had to expose it. An aerogel is already inside of a wet gel, and in fact, the solid structure of a wet gel, isolated from its liquid component, is exactly what an aerogel is.
So it starts out as kind of like a bunch of like strings of these strengthening molecules around all this liquid, and then we take away the liquid, and all that's left is the strengthening.
So you could think of it kind of like there's a skeleton, like a coral type structure, sponge like structure, with liquid held in the pores. And when if we can carefully extract the liquid from the pores of that gel, then we're left over with a very low density sponge like solid material, and that's what the aerogel is.
So can I just leave my Jello out and let it dry, and then I'll have an aerogel?
Generally not. What happens if you leave a gel out in the air and you allow the liquid to evaporate from the pores, which will happen spontaneously, the solid framework will collapse in on itself and it densifies into a hard glass-like substance, and we call that material zero gel with an X. It means it comes from Greek, which means like a dry gel. So aerogel, on the other hand, is made through some technique, and there's a bunch of different ways to do it, by which we've eliminated that collapse, where we've prevented that collapsing action from happening. So the way we do this, there's two primary ways to do it. One way is through what's called supercritical drying. So we take the gel and we put it into a special pressure vessel, and we heat the liquid in the gel past what's called its critical point. You can read all about this on aerogel.org. And at a critical point, a liquid becomes what's called a supercritical fluid, and has properties of both a gas and a liquid at the same time. It's like a liquid in that it has the density of a liquid, and if you could touch it, it would feel like a liquid. But it at the same time expands to fill its container like a gas would, and can be depressurized like a gas. And so once we've converted the liquid in the gel to a supercritical fluid, we can depressurize our vessel.
But you wouldn't want to touch it because it's really
it's high under
pressure.
High pressure. Yeah, very up to
kind of squishy, about, pretty good.
At least 100 atmospheres, depending on how you're doing it. And you depressurize your vessel, and at the end of this, you've very sneakily taken what was liquid in the gel, turned it into this sort of like weird supercritical fluid, and then turned the supercritical fluid into a gas. And now, without invoking any kind of capillary stress on the gel, you've created what you've extracted the liquid from its pores and made an aerogel.
So we kind of fooled the gel kind into of, thinking yeah, it still had a liquid, right. But really it had a gas.
Yeah, we're pretty sneaky that way.
Okay,
that's right. So, Will, let's talk about ourselves.
Well, I think it's important that those of you who are listening have an idea who we are and what we're doing behind aerogel, and that we're out there, and what our motivation is for putting all this crazy information out there for you to get to. Stephen, why don't you tell us where you come from and what you know about aerogels and why you know it.
Let's see. Well, I'm originally from Glendale, Wisconsin. I went to the University of Wisconsin for my undergrad, and I studied chemistry. While I was there, I did two major, I had two research focuses. One of them was doing organosilicon chemistry with Professor Bob West, and the other was investigating the effects of microgravity on the formation of aerogels, and you can learn all about that in a later podcast. I then did my master's degree at MIT here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I studied material science, and I worked on carbon aerogels and moved into carbon nanotubes, which are another cool material. And I'm now a PhD student here at MIT in the Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics, where I research advanced materials, focusing primarily on carbon nanotubes and advanced composites.
And fun fact, you're also one of how many licensed flight attendants?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I'm one of the nine flight directors for the Zero Gravity Corporation in my spare time. That's right.
Which it means that Stephen is like a flight attendant, but for a plane that does a lot of crazy maneuvers.
I personally prefer the term space stewardess.
All right. Sounds good. My name's Will Walker, and I ironically come from Waukesha, Wisconsin, so we kind of originate, you know, in the same neck of the woods in the U.S. But
we didn't know each other in Wisconsin, actually.
Not at all. This is kind of a late-blooming collaboration. I have a background in visual art. I went to the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore, Maryland. And I got an undergraduate degree in painting and a graduate degree in art teaching, actually. After school, I got out and I started developing a body of work that really walks the line between what I'd call the wonder of science fiction and the beauty of overlooked commonplace materials. And I kind of deal between those two things. So that might take the place, that might take place in terms of making momentary sculptures that exist only for a few seconds made out of explosions. You know, I do other works that are like bridges, three-dimensional bridges made out of, you know, glue and paper and cardboard and just really common materials. So I work in a whole variety of mediums. And about two and a half years ago, I learned about silica aerogel, and I was very interested in exploring the possibility of casting it for use in my sculptures. And I decided to follow up on this. I learned that there was very limited information out there about casting it, about working with it as a material, about how to get started in it as an artist. And so I realized that I needed to get have sort of a funding source to kind of talk to a scientist and maybe do a little research into this myself. At that point, I applied for a Pollitt-Krasner grant and received it to study aerogels. So about 2 years ago, I approached Stephen with my grant and said, let's, you know, investigate working on casting silica aerogel. And Stephen was game, so we've began this collaboration. And we've, over the years, we've tried a number of different formulations. We've explored a whole range of aerogels, and we've kind of documented our process. And one of the things that I kind of insisted upon and was really interested in was publishing our material through the internet and allowing other people to follow in our footsteps and benefit from our experience. And I feel like it's really important to bring bring an open source concept to this technology so that those of you out there who are interested in making your own experiments and exploring can benefit from what we've done. You don't have to repeat everything that we've, you know, all our mistakes and failures and all our, you know, successes, and maybe we'll be learning from you in the future.
So I'd like to ask you a question, Will. From your perspective, is aerogel something that anybody could do? If you, coming not from a science or heavily technical background, were able to get into this, is this something anybody can do?
Well, in high school, I took chemistry and physics, and that's given me a little bit of a grounding to begin to approach this subject. There's a lot on the internet that kind of makes aerogels really sensational and seem like this miracle material, and I think that it really is something that anyone can approach, and there's a whole range of ways that you can approach it. So you don't necessarily need to be at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory with a, you know, a hot supercritical dryer, you know, with a blast shield in order to make some really cool stuff. And hopefully we'll be bringing that to you through the website in the future.
So on the subject of aerogels and making them on your own, I would just like to say that aerogel is something that you personally can not only get involved with and learn about, but actually make yourself with some patience, with some practice, and with some experimentation. So when I was in high school, I became interested in aerogels, and I remember reading about aerogels on Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory's aerogel site, which was written by Dr. Mike Ayers and Dr. Arlen Hunt. And on that site, they talked about, they had a procedure for making aerogels, and they talked generally about the supercritical drying process. And so I wondered, so at that point I asked myself, I wonder if I can make an aerogel. And so as we talked a little bit
like
earlier.
Like most high school students, yeah, well, at some point in their life,
well,
wonder.
Well, you know, many, I get emails all the time from high school students asking, you know, how hard is this to make? You know, how did you build your manuclave, which is what I call my manually controlled autoclave, you might have seen pictures of on the web. But, you know, I get questions from people all the time. Is this something that I can do? And it is. And so the way I got started was, so as we talked about earlier, aerogels, there's generally two steps to making aerogels. One is making a gel, and then two is doing supercritical drying to turn that into an aerogel, although there are other ways of doing it now. But I decided, well, I don't have a supercritical dryer. I don't really know how to do that, but at least I could get started making the wet gels. And so I talked with my high school chemistry teacher, Mr. Ron LeMay, and he helped me to order some of the chemicals that I needed and gave me access to the vent hood at my high school during the summer so I could mix some chemicals up. And the unfortunately speaking, the procedure on Lawrence Berkeley's site doesn't quite work as published. So it took me quite a while to get it to get something to work, and I came up with a process finally for making my own gels. At that point, school had come into session, and I was determined and wasn't about to listen to anyone who suggested otherwise that I was going to make aerogels. And so I started calling around University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, which is the school nearby my high school, University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is a bigger school. It's different labs in the area, and I could not find an autoclave suitable for doing supercritical drying, let alone a dedicated supercritical dryer. I was able to find a couple biological autoclaves, but generally these only get to about 2 atmospheres in pressure. You need something that's much more than that in order to do supercritical drying.
That and they're a little pricey.
Oh, yeah, it's a good point that if I were to say, oh, I'm just going to try to buy one, you know, work through the summer and pay for one. I mean, the cheapest supercritical dryer you can really get is about $15,000. So it wasn't something you could that I was set up to really do. And so at that point, I started reading about more about aerogel production and cold calling scientists at Lawrence Berkeley. So I talked to Mike Ayers and Arlen Hunt myself. And then also some scientists at Lawrence Livermore, particularly Dr. Tom Tillotson, who I am greatly indebted to and have a great deal of respect for, about what these supercritical dryers look like and what you need in order to actually put one together and how the process worked. And after a significant amount of talking and researching, I had a good sense of at least the pressures that I needed to operate in. And the valves and things that had to go into this. And so my dad is a salesman for industrial equipment, and so I talked to him about what I wanted to do, and he got me some catalogs of high-pressure pipes and pipe fittings. And
so most parents would probably be like, you're going to do what?
Well,
and your dad was kind of like, hey, let's get you some catalogs. Let's get you looking at this.
Well, you know, that's one thing that's really great about my parents is that they have always been very supportive. They're not scientists. They're not engineers. Probably for better or for worse, because I think on one hand, you know, they encouraged me to, you know, to follow my passions and do this kind of stuff. But on the other hand, they knew what I was doing. Maybe they wouldn't have let me do it. But in any case, yeah, so I looked through some catalogs. I found some parts that fit the bill of what I needed. And we ordered them. I got them in, screwed them together, got a gas tank, plugged it on and screwed it on and it leaked like mad. Then I learned about Teflon tape and how to seal pipe fittings together. And after a good deal of effort, I came up, I finally finished, built a machine or put together a system that could hold pressure and do supercritical drying. And after about 40 unsuccessful trials, or partially successful trials in some cases, I finally made an aerogel of my own. And I did this all in my basement in Glendale, Wisconsin. And so I guess the moral of the story is that it is very doable for someone with a high school education to make aerogels in the traditional sense, going all the way from chemistry to supercritical dryer construction, finally to actually implementing supercritical drying if you're have the patience and the drive to do so.
And we're here to make it easier.
Exactly. And so to get you started so that you don't have to repeat so many of the mistakes that we've had to go through.
And there have been mistakes.
Yeah, you can learn all about how to build a supercritical dryer of your own, how to make gels, and how to successfully turn them into aerogels under the Make section of aerogel.org, along with some general guides about how to keep a logbook, how to do all of this safely.
How not to blow out your windows.
Exactly.
When you open your supercritical dryer.
And how to set up a lab space and how to really get going. So
so that's one section of our site. What are some of what's another? Can you give us an idea of some of the other sections of the site?
Sure. So the first section you'll come across on the site is the Learn section. So this is an encyclopedic resource about aerogels. So in under Learn, you'll find information about what aerogels are, how they're made, the different flavors of aerogels. So that's our term for the different compositions of aerogels you can produce. In addition to a complete history of aerogel, going all the way back to its initial discovery somewhere around 1929 by Samuel Stevens Kistler through the beginning of the 21st century. You'll also find there's a section called C.
And this is kind of my, I guess this would be the fruits of my labor, you might call it. This is going to feature a lot of photographs of our processes, of the samples that we've created, and you're going to see a lot of my photography there. Eventually, we hope to have a little bit of a database of artworks created with aerogel that's coming down the line. And that's not all that we're going to feature. What do we have planned for the future, Stephen?
So, of course, we'll have additional podcasts, which we'll get to in a second. But you'll also be able to read about the scientists that are changing the face of aerogel every day. So we'll have featured scientists, as well as videos and other cool media about aerogels. Lastly, I guess you'll find the Explore section where you can learn about how to learn chemistry if you're interested in learning chemistry, how to cite aerogel.org in a bibliography, where to find journal articles about aerogels.
And by the way, I have to plug here the MIT open courseware. You can audit MIT courses through their website. I found the chemistry class to be incredibly informative, and it's giving me the vocabulary to really approach this, even though I come from an art background. And my vocabulary is much more cultural than scientifically rigorous, but this is really getting me up to speed and allowing me to, talk about this, in the way that I need to.
So what you'll also see us doing as we move forward with aerogel.org is adding more interactivity. So we want aerogel.org to be a living community where you can not only ask questions and learn from other users, but then post your own results, post your own designs and ideas, and contribute back to the aerogel community. And I think what you'll discover if you actually get into this and try to start making aerogels yourself, that there's a lot to be done, and that even a high schooler can make a useful contribution to the field of aerogels. And even when I was in high school, a number of the things that I came up with in working with aerogels, I got a patent for, and I was only 17 at the time. So definitely a lot of cool things out there for you to to do and get involved in.
So what's coming up on the podcast, Stephen?
Sure, up on the podcast, we've got Peter Hsu from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He's the principal investigator of the Stardust mission that used aerogel to capture comet dust. We've got Dr. Alex Gash from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and he's going to tell us about colorful metal oxide aerogels and aerogels that can be used as explosives. And we've got George Gould from Aspen Aerogels, Dr. George Gould, who's going to tell us about commercially available aerogel.
Yeah, and Aspen's really taking aerogels and putting them out there in, you know, in the public.
Right? Yeah, and by the way, you can actually buy aerogel at Walmart now in the form of a product called Toasty Feet, which has aerogel insulation in an insole you can put into your shoe. So that's pretty cool. So with that, I think that wraps up this podcast.
We just want to say, you know, we hope that you'll be coming back to the site. We hope to be bringing more information down the road. We have a lot of exciting things going on, and you'll see that published in the future. And come back for more podcasts. We hope you'll subscribe and keep listening.
Absolutely. And remember, aerogel's not just for NASA anymore. Log on and get involved. This is open source nanotechnology, which means that you can contribute and you can make a difference. For aerogel.org, I'm Steven Steiner.
And I'm Will Walker.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on The Critical Point.